It is Thursday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a new book looks into the psychology of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump.
We found someone who, at his core, is kind of a solitary man, almost a lonely man, but in public has built this character that he plays, Donald Trump.
Several Hong Kong journalists say Chinese police in Wuhan beat and detain them. And a new film explores the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It's all ahead. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is back on the campaign trail after recuperating for 3 days from a bout with pneumonia. But her Republican challenger, Donald Trump, is mocking her stamina. Meanwhile, Trump's campaign released results from a physical exam he had last week, suggesting that Trump, but not Clinton, could withstand the rigors of a presidential contest. A new book entitled Trump Revealed, An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power, looks at the background and views of the billionaire businessman. The authors, Washington Post journalist Mark Fisher and investigative political reporter Michael Cranish, spoke with VOA's Ramon Taylor in our New York studio. Fisher begins the discussion.
Donald Trump has spent a lifetime as a performer, as a showman. He thinks of himself as a showman, and he has built his real estate empire and his business ventures around the world on the basis of his personality, his image, his brand. And so it's been very important to him from the very start to build that image. And what we wanted to do was see, is there anything behind that image? What are his core principles, his beliefs? What formed him and what created the political animal that he's come to be in the past year? We found someone who, at his core, is kind of a solitary man, almost a lonely man, but in public has built this character that he plays, Donald Trump, and that character he's really become one with that person.
In attempting to understand how Trump thinks, decides, and ultimately acts, what would you consider to be some of the more revealing moments, to quote the name of the book, from his past that give you a greater glimpse or understanding of how he might operate if he were elected president?
One of the revealing moments for Donald Trump that we write about extensively in the book is the time in 1973. Donald Trump, as a young man, just got out of Wharton, been president of his father's real estate company for several years, and he and his father, Fred Trump, who oversaw an empire of 14,000 rental units in Brooklyn and Queens, they were sued by the federal government for race discrimination in the way they rented or didn't rent to blacks. And the government had a extensive suit against them. And Donald Trump had to decide for his father and himself, would he settle with the federal government and make the case go away? The government wasn't asking for money. They just wanted Donald Trump to basically agree to advertise his units openly and attract more black tenants. But Donald Trump decided that he wanted to fight the federal government. He ran into a man named Roy Cohn, an infamous lawyer who had worked for Joe McCarthy, the senator from Wisconsin. Roy Cohn told him, you need to fight the government, fight like hell. And that's what Trump decided to do. Trump was told by Cohn, when they hit you, hit back 10 times harder. They've countersued the federal government for $100 million. That counterclaim was immediately tossed out of court. And for 2 years, they fought the government, and in the end, Trump signed a consent decree in which he basically didn't admit wrongdoing, but did agree to place ads saying he was an equal opportunity housing person and that blacks could apply and should apply. So Trump could sort of claim victory. He didn't have to admit guilt, but the government also claimed victory. They said this is one of the most historic settlements we've ever reached. So the bottom line from that story is that, number one, Donald Trump to this day retains an animus towards the federal government, feels that it was wrong that he was sued for racial bias, but a lot of people look at that case, put it in their memory bank and say, well, there's a question there about his attitudes towards race. And number two, Donald Trump learned from Roy Cohn, when they hit you, hit back 10 times or 100 times harder. So it's a very revealing episode, the first time Donald Trump is really introduced to the public, and it's one that still dogs him to this day.
Let's talk about some of his abilities. You write in your analysis that Trump is hugely confident in his abilities, not terribly well-informed, quick to take offense. You also mentioned Trump's history of making decisions by himself, referring to an interview in which he called himself the Lone Ranger. In all your election coverage over the years, how different are these qualities from past and even current presidential candidates? Is there any precedent?
Donald Trump certainly is a world unto himself when it comes to being a presidential candidate who runs a very, very small operation in his campaign. Only half a dozen people got him through the primary season and quite successfully. He's someone who does not have a history of taking advice from large numbers of people. He's someone who doesn't read deeply when he's exploring a new issue, a new position that he'd like to take. We asked him about reading habits because I thought, well, he's fairly likely to be president, or at least has a 50-50 chance. And how are you preparing? And what are you reading? Are you reading biographies of great presidents? And he said, no, I've always wanted to, but I've never had the chance. And similarly, when we asked about how he would make decisions as president, he said he's not one who reads deeply. He's not one who wants people to come to him with big, long reports. He likes to rule from the gut, make decisions from the gut. He believes deeply in his instincts. And that sets him apart from most presidents and presidential candidates. Most candidates like to think of themselves as having very deeply set ideological principles. Donald Trump is allergic to ideology. He is the ultimate pragmatist, and he believes that as a chief executive of a large business operation, that kind of background has prepared him for whatever may come.
Mark Fisher and Michael Cranish, authors of the new book, Trump Revealed, An American Journey of Ambition, Ego, Money, and Power. They spoke with VOA's Ramon Taylor. Well, our regular social media segment has a space theme today, and Michael Lippin is here to tell us about it. Michael, why space?
Hi, Sarah. Well, let me tell you, there are two big accomplishments for space exploration that are getting attention today on social media. The first is China successfully launching its second ever space lab into orbit around the Earth. The space lab is called Tiangong 2, and it launched from the Jiuquan Launch Center in northwestern China at 14:04 Universal Time today. Video of the launch can be found on Twitter. Check out Chinese state TV channel CCTV News and its Twitter feed. They posted this message a short while ago. China successfully sends space lab Tiangong 2 into orbit. Click to review the spectacular launch. Well, I've seen lots of messages of excitement coming in from space fans on Twitter. From user Rachel Williams, who is a California-based space blogger, she writes, "Did anyone else stop breathing? It felt like an eternity for this candle to light." And by candle, of course, she's talking about the rocket that is being launched. And this message from Twitter user whose handle is @Barbie_BB. "What a lovely name for a space station. Hashtag Heavenly Palace." And that's actually the English translation of the space lab's Chinese name, Tiangong. Now, China plans to launch two astronauts into space next month aboard a space capsule called Shenzhou 11, and that's going to connect with Tiangong 2, so those astronauts can actually spend a month in the lab conducting experiments.
Well, what's the other space topic of the day?
Well, one of the top trends on Facebook is actually the Milky Way, which is the name of our galaxy. Facebook says 100,000 people have been talking about it. Why? Well, that's because yesterday the European Space Agency released the most detailed images ever of the Milky Way, and those images came from a satellite called Gaia that it launched in 2013, and which has been circling our sun on a mission to map the billions of stars thought to be in our galaxy. Gaia's camera is so powerful that it has a billion pixels and would be able to gauge the diameter of a human hair at a distance of 1,000 kilometers. That's pretty powerful, huh?
Very powerful. Thank you very much, Michael. That is Michael Lippin. Here are some of the top stories trending. The world's seas are getting better protection. People in Maine consider deeply personal gun control questions. The rise of Hong Kong localists in an election puts the United States in a quandary. And a South Korean documentary alleges mistreatment of North Korean asylum seekers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Australia may have come up with a unique solution to fight antimicrobial-resistant infections, or superbugs, a growing worldwide concern. The researchers found that star-shaped objects they created with short chains of proteins called peptide polymers might be able to replace traditional antibiotics. Doctors have long prescribed antibiotics to fight various bacteria-borne ailments from acne to pneumonia. But using these drugs repeatedly over time can cause many of these microbes to mutate and build a resistance against medications made to fight them. After testing their star-shaped peptide polymers on animal models, the researchers found them to be effective in killing superbugs. They also discovered that antibiotic-resistant microbes showed no signs of fighting this new treatment method. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new film explores the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Journalists from Hong Kong say they were beaten and detained by Chinese police while attempting to cover the violent crackdown on protesters in the village of Wuhan. Two newspapers, the South China Morning Post and Ming Pao, said their employees were assaulted and subsequently detained Wednesday night while attempting to interview villagers about the protest. The reporters were inside a villager's house when police kicked in the door and forced them to kneel on the ground. Ma Kinting is a member of the China Concerns Committee of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. She tells me about the assault against the reporters.
I heard that there were about 30 to 40 policemen rush into the home of villagers where the reporters stayed, and the policemen claimed that they received complaint of alleged theft, so they have to rush in and catch the criminal. But of course it is only an excuse, because those reporters were accepted by the villagers who want the reporters cover the confrontation between the policemen and the villagers so that their voice can be heard. So there is no report whatsoever about alleged theft. It was an excuse used by the policemen. And even though the reporter have not struggled back, they were violently beaten or pressed down on the ground on the floor and then were taken away violently. Almost, you know, several policemen picking up a reporter and then taking them away and put them under custody for several hours. And they were released at only around 3 o'clock in the morning of Thursday.
Have their news organizations protested their treatment? Do you know that?
I read that those reporters included our reporters from Ming Pao, South China Morning Post, and web newspaper Hong Kong 01. And I only read that the Ming Pao have issued a protest statement condemning that the authorities violently prompting on press freedom. And the other would like to keep a more low profile. But this is not a thing that can be kept low profile. So Hong Kong Journalists Association and Get In Hands with several other media-related groups issue a joint statement strongly condemns the Chinese public security officers' violent treatment against the Hong Kong journalists.
Has there been any response from the Chinese government or from the police in Wuhan to those protests?
As usual, they will not respond to the condemn of the outside authorities. And as usual, we do not heard anything from the policemen in China. But more important is that the Hong Kong government and the Chinese Liaison Office in Hong Kong should do their part to relay the protests of the Hong Kong media circle to the mainland authorities so as to keep the interests of Hong Kong people as well as the mainland people. Because, I mean, the suppression of the violent attack on journalists is an attack on press freedom. This is so sure. And the most important thing during the discussion or the warning of the policemen against the reporters is that they have the reporters, the Hong Kong reporters, were forced to sign a kind of memorandum that they will not illegally covering news in Wuhan. But as a matter of fact, one of the detained reporters having a correspondent permit issued by China authorities, so he should be covering the news legally.
That's Ma Ying-Ting, a member of the China Concerns Committee of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new movie takes a more personal look at the worst marine oil spill in history on board a drilling platform in the Gulf of Mexico. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Deepwater Horizon looks at the lives of some of the people killed in the initial explosion, as well as the aftermath of the disaster.
In April of 2010, an explosion and fire crippled the oil drilling platform the Deepwater Horizon in the Gulf of Mexico. Cement meant to contain the natural gas in the well failed, and the gas shot up the drilling tube and ignited. 11 workers were killed and 17 others injured in the explosion. The rig, which was leased by British Petroleum and operated by Transocean, sank. Then a device called a blowout preventer, which is intended to stop oil from leaking out of the well 1,500-plus meters below, failed. Millions of barrels of oil leaked into the Gulf over the next few weeks. In the film Deepwater Horizon, Mark Wahlberg plays oil rig worker Mike Williams. At the film's premiere at the Toronto Film Festival, Wahlberg said that rebuilding the disaster site in Louisiana during hurricane season was challenging, but worth the effort for the integrity of the film.
But, you know, it's the kind of movie like Lone Survivor where it's not about your own individual experience and you suck it up because, you know, we're paying tribute to the 11 people that lost their lives and all the men and women who were able to survive the Deepwater tragedy. So, you know, when you're aware of those things, it makes it a lot easier.
Actress Kate Hudson plays Mike Williams' wife, Felicia. She says there was added pressure knowing that the real families of the real victims would see the movie.
And so there's this little extra importance that's put on making sure that you get it right. And so I think that was one. And also, I just it's nice to be a part of a film that kind of switches it. You know, you got this obviously enormous environmental disaster, but at the same time, we kind of lost sight of the fact that 11 lives were lost, and it's nice to sort of pay homage to them and their families.
Veteran actor Kurt Russell plays Deepwater manager Jimmy Harrell. Russell says he hadn't known about the number of people killed on the rig until he read the script.
But I had no idea. I had no idea 11 people had died. I didn't see anything on that. I didn't see anything on the oil rig burning. Explosions that you could see from space. I didn't know that there were acts of miraculous heroism that occurred to help people stay alive. And I thought, yeah, where's that? That story is not as important as the ecological potential disaster.
Director Peter Berg credits his Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist uncle for his passion for depicting real stories. He also directed and produced Wahlberg's 2013 reality-based Lone Survivor.
I've always been a believer that if you can find a real great story and you can get access to those the people who are part of it and the culture that they represent, that to me is where the inspiration comes, and that's where the gold is for me.
Deepwater Horizon also stars Oscar nominee John Malkovich, Maze Runner star Dylan O'Brien, and Jane the Virgin star Gina Rodriguez. The film is rated PG-13 for language and intense disaster sequences. Deepwater Horizon opens in U.S. theaters September 30th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much there, David. Well, the world's oldest man is preparing to celebrate his bar mitzvah 100 years late. Yisrael Kristol, who at the age of 113 is recognized by Guinness World Records as the oldest man in the world, well, he was unable to celebrate the Jewish rite of passage when he was 13 because his mother had recently died and his father was in the Russian army fighting in World War I. Well, a bar mitzvah is usually it's held when a Jew reaches the age of being responsible for their actions. That's usually at age 13 for boys and 12 or 13 for girls. Kristol was born on September 15th, 1903 in what is now Poland, but he currently lives in Haifa, Israel. The family said the celebration will be held late this month, but the family is keeping kind of quiet about the location because they're worried about having a throng of journalists around. Well, the drama in Kristol's life was not just isolated to World War I. During World War II, he was sent to the infamous Nazi concentration camp, Auschwitz, where his wife and two children died. When freed by the Russian army in 1945, Kristol weighed a mere 37 kilos. Well, congratulations, and it's great that he's finally getting to mark that achievement. That's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the U.S. State Department is offering up to $3 million for information leading to the location, arrest, and/or conviction of a key ISIL operative, Gulmurad Halimov. Halimov was born in Tajikistan in 1975 and is a former Tajik Special Operations Colonel, police commander, and military sniper. He was once the commander of a police special operations unit in the Ministry of Interior of Tajikistan. He is now a member of ISIL, or Daesh, as it is called in Arabic, and an ISIL recruiter. In May 2015, he announced in a 10-minute propaganda video that he fights for the terrorist group, and he has called publicly for violent acts against the United States, Russia, and Tajikistan. The United States designated Halimov a specially designated global terrorist in September 2015. He was also sanctioned by the United Nations as a terrorist in February 2016. He is wanted by the government of Tajikistan. In June 2015, Interpol issued a red notice for Halimov, alerting member nations that he is a wanted person and should be apprehended for extradition to Tajikistan. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. If you have information on Gulmurad Halimov, contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at rewardsforjustice.net. Email at info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone at 1-800-877-3927, or mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.